Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In March 2015, Lavette Mays owned her own business, had two kids, no criminal history. Then she got into a fight with her mother-in-law. That got her arrested, and the judge set her bail at $250,000. She couldn't pay, so she spent the next 426 days in jail in Cook County, Illinois, another 145 days with an electric monitor, 571 days in total, all before ever going to trial.
When I got out, I had already lost everything. I had lost housing. I had lost almost custody of my kids. It was a lot of things that was going on.
Among the things she lost, her business. Before going to jail, Mays had been the owner of a small transportation company.
Because it was a lot of stuff that was going on the streets, I started transportation. My kids was in private school. So because they were in private school, I was able to get contracts and everything. So I did field trips. I worked for the charter schools where I was picking kids up, taking them home. And I had like plenty of contracts that I was doing for the schools.
That work was gone. She also didn't see her children while incarcerated. And ultimately, Mays got out of jail after more than a year and a half when her bond was reduced to an amount she could pay. She says her family is still suffering the impacts of her time in jail.
When you incarcerate a woman, you incarcerate the whole family. We never got out of counseling. We're still being counseled as of today because of that, because it really affected them. I had never been out of their life. It was hard on them. And as of today, it still, you know, affect them. It still affect me as of today.
Well, more than 1,000 miles away and 6 years later, another family is dealing with the consequences of pretrial incarceration. Goldie's husband, Jerome, has been in jail in Harris County, Texas, since November 13th.
It's just a cash bond system who don't have the money available to get their loved ones out of there. And that's what's going on with me right now. I just don't have the cash to get him out. It's like $11,000 to get him out. I just don't have that.
We're not using Goldie and Jerome's last name because his case is currently pending. They've been married for 36 years. They have 3 children and 4 grandkids. They met while serving in the United States Navy. Just a few weeks ago, Jerome's jail, like the rest of Texas, was hit by an unprecedented winter storm.
He called me and, you know, the toilets were overflowing. They didn't have water. They were getting cold sack lunches or dinner. One night they weren't even able to eat dinner. They just told them, hey, just go to bed without dinner. We don't have any dinner for you all. And one of the guards wouldn't let them wear blankets. You know, it was freezing, but they couldn't even have a blanket on, you know, and with short sleeves that they have on. That was just, I was so worried about him during that time.
Jerome suffers PTSD related to his Navy service, including a deployment to support the war in Afghanistan. He hasn't received treatment while in jail, and his next court date is on March 30th. His last court date was 2 months ago in January when Goldie says nothing happened.
You know, it's hard. I have contacted tried to get in touch with his attorney 3 or 4 times. You know, he's a public attorney, so he's not returning my calls. I sent him an email. He's not sending me an email back or anything. And I have asked for that, but I have gotten no response. No response from his court-appointed lawyer.
Because of their naval careers, Goldie and Jerome have been separated before, so they know what it's like to be apart, but not like this.
You know, he missed Thanksgiving. He missed Christmas. He's missing, you know, my birthday is on the 19th. He's going to miss that as well. And, you know, he sacrificed a lot for this country. He did 20 years in the military, and You know, we went through all of this when he was in the military. He missed a lot of days.
Goldie now also again misses her husband.
It's kind of been hard during the pandemic without him.
And again, Jerome is in a Harris County jail, still innocent until proven guilty, all because his family is unable to pay an $11,000 bond. He's among hundreds of thousands of Americans in pretrial detention simply because they lack money. A disproportionate number of those Americans are Black and Latino. But in Illinois, that is about to change, because last week, Illinois became the first state in the country to eliminate cash bail. When Lavette Mays was released from jail in Cook County, she began working with the Chicago Community Bond Fund, advocating for bail reform.
I'm very excited. I am so extremely excited. I vowed to the women that I was in jail with, and I was like, I'm going to make sure that this never happens again.
So today we're going to talk about what Illinois did, why it did it, and potential lessons for the rest of the country regarding the use of cash bail. And I'm joined now by Christine Scott Hayward, professor of law, criminology, and criminal justice at California State University, Long Beach, as well as the co-author of Punishing Poverty, How Bail and Pretrial Detention Fuel Inequalities in the Criminal Justice System. Professor Hayward, welcome to On Point.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And also with us is Sharon Mitchell, director of the Illinois Justice Project and former trial attorney with the Cook County Public Defender's Office. And Sharon joins us from Chicago. Welcome to On Point.
Hello.
So I wonder, Sharon, if I can just start with you. Can you just give us a sense as to how major this reform is in Illinois in the state's decision to eliminate cash bail?
You know, we feel we're a bit biased, but it is the most progressive piece of a pretrial reform legislation this country has ever seen. Too often our system uses money to make decisions about who should be in jail and who shouldn't be. And that use really is a driving factor behind the ills that we know exist in this justice system: wrongful convictions, mass incarceration, so on and so forth. So this is incredible. This is an incredible first step in really returning the justice system to where it should be. And we are excited that we had an opportunity to play a role in this massive change.
So this is part of basically a sweeping criminal justice reform bill that Governor J.B. Pritzker signed at the end of February or near the end of February. It's one part of this reform law. Can you tell us a little bit more? Is all cash bail now for every type of pretrial detention has been eliminated from Illinois?
Yeah, there are certainly jurisdictions that have reduced their use of cash bond. Cook County, the county which encompasses Chicago, has been one of those jurisdictions that has reduced their use of cash bond. New Jersey has essentially ended cash bond. They did that, I think, around 2017, but this bill eradicates it fully. It does not end pretrial detention. Judges will still have the ability to make decisions in a limited amount of circumstances whether somebody should go to jail for public safety or for reasons of willful flight from prosecution, if they're at risk of willful flight from prosecution. But money will no longer be that determining factor. And that is, you know, may have a real impact on communities all across the state.
Yeah. And so just again, for the sake of clarity, this is for all types of charges, misdemeanors, and felonies?
Yeah, so okay. Cash bond will be eradicated. It will not be an option for any type of criminal case. You won't be able to buy your way out of jail. Judges won't be able to rely on cash bond to detain people. Yeah.
So how many people in Illinois do you think this might have an impact on?
You know, it's going to be a large number. We know that there are over 1,000 people in Cook County Jail who, if they had money, would be released. We know that about 250,000 people go into jail in the state per year. And we know that many of those folks, 90% of those folks, are locked up awaiting trial. And we know that there's a significant majority of those folks that are there on a cash bond. There are 102 counties. on Illinois, and you know, county numbers vary from county to county, but we know it's in the thousands.
Yeah. So I just want to reiterate something, because I think this is one of those facts about the criminal justice system that perhaps we don't understand fully enough, and or don't
jails
hear
versus
often
prison.
Enough. Well, yeah. And then also that you said 90% of people who are in jail in Illinois are there with pretrial detention, right? And so,
yes.
And so therefore, many of them are also there, as you said, because they can't pay, they can't post the bond to get out. So, so to be clear, they have not yet been convicted of anything. They are still innocent until proven guilty, but for many cases, out of the lack of money, they are incarcerated.
Yeah, allegedly they're innocent to proven guilty. Given the conditions that they are held in, I think that is obviously a misnomer. But we are talking about folks where no piece of evidence has been presented against them, until we're getting to a trial. This is pre-trial. This is before a trial, before plea. This is where the case has not been decided, but the punishment is still commencing.
Okay, so Professor Hayward, let me turn back to you, because how dramatic is this change in Illinois?
I mean, it's huge, right? As Sharon said, it's the first state to completely eliminate cash bail. And if it operates in the same fashion as the reforms in New Jersey operated, then you're going to see a lot more people who are released pending trial. And that's the ultimate goal, right, of bail reform, is to reduce the number of people who are locked up pending trial.
And so were you surprised that Illinois took this sweeping step? Do you consider it the first domino, or is it an outlier right now?
Well, I think it's part of a larger movement. And so there's reform happening around the country at the state level and at the local level also. And different states have taken different approaches, right? So you have states like Illinois and New Jersey who have done it at a legislative level. But you also have states like Maryland and Ohio whose Supreme Courts have made decisions. And so I wouldn't say that it is an outlier. I would say it goes further. And there are some key elements of the legislation that I think will really show other states that you can go a little bit further
right.
than you might otherwise have to.
Well, when we have, we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about what those elements are. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking about why Illinois, late last month, became the first state in the country to eliminate all cash bail in part of a massive criminal justice reform bill that was signed by Governor J.B. Pritzker late last month, and what lessons Illinois' Act may have for the rest of the country. I'm joined today by Sharon Mitchell, who's director of the Illinois Justice Project. Christine Scott Hayward joins us as well. She's professor of law, criminology, and criminal justice at California State University, Long Beach. We're going to dive into sort of a few more specifics of what happened in Illinois in a couple of minutes. But Professor Hayward, I actually wanted to take a really big step back here and get a sense as to why a cash bail system even exists in the United States. So first of all, Globally, how common is this kind of cash bail system?
Well, cash bail does exist in a lot of countries, and it is particularly common in common law countries. So, you know, the UK, Ireland, Canada still has cash bail also. The big distinction, which was the one I think you made at the top of the hour, was the fact that we rely on commercial bail in this country, which all those other countries that use cash bail do not. So cash bail is not that rare. It's the commercial bail aspect of it that is so rare.
So explain more what you mean by the commercial bail aspect then.
So the idea that private companies are the mechanism by which most people obtain release. So, for example, in Canada, which uses cash bail, there is no commercial bail. And so people, you know, might have a friend or a family member that would post the bond with the court for them, or there might be other ways for them to obtain release. But in the U.S., most states, and Illinois was one that abolished commercial bail a while ago, but most states still allow private companies to post that bail. And so what happens is typically, you know, let's say the court sets the bail at $10,000. If the person doesn't have $10,000 to deposit with the court, they will turn to a private bail agency. Typically, they will say 10%, you need to pay us 10%. So the person or their family will pay $1,000 to that bail bond agent in order to basically buy their freedom. And what's important to note is that that money will never come back to them, right? They are paying that $1,000 as a fee to the bond agent to allow them to get out of jail.
Whereas if they had paid the bond directly to the county, they would get that money back.
Correct. Exactly. Yes.
Okay. I mean, these details really matter because this, as you said, this is a thing that makes the system here in the United States and I believe Philippines unique worldwide. And so therefore, to be clear, it's a business.
It is a business. Yes. And so you have seen in New Jersey, you didn't see it in Illinois, obviously, because there was no commercial bail industry there. But in New Jersey, in New York, you see the bail industry lobbying significantly against these reform bills because their business will disappear. And, you know, sometimes the advertising that you see, you know, refers to sort of small mom and pop companies. But it's important to remember that most of these commercial bail agencies are sort of backed by large insurance companies, and they make a lot of money. So it's not always the case that, you know, putting a small company out of business is the issue. It's these larger insurance companies who are losing their businesses.
Sharon Mitchell, let me turn back to you, because as Professor Hayward says, the commercial bondsman business was eliminated in Illinois prior to this reform package that we're talking about today. So why then did sort of the regular cash bail, non-commercial, though, persist in Illinois? What was the reasoning and justification for that until late February?
Well, there's still a desire to use the money from bail payments to help fund court services. So in Illinois, we have a similar system. We don't have private bail industry, but there is a percentage of the money that does stay with the government. So if I have a, let's say, $100,000 bail in every county but one in Illinois, the county will essentially keep 10% of what you actually pay. So there is still a monetary interest in keeping the bail system alive. I will say as well, the system, this is kind of a little deeper, the system relies on people being incarcerated to run smoothly. The vast majority of cases in the system end in plea bargains, and the majority of people who do go into jail plead guilty because they are in a really bad spot. So there's no wonder that, you know, folks who are in jail are more likely to plead guilty, and they're more likely to serve a longer sentence. So I think the good professor brought up a great point early on that while ending money bond is certainly something that is beneficial to communities and something we're very happy to have, Reducing pretrial detention, we believe, will produce a more fair and more just situation.
Okay, so on this point of it being a source of funding, though, of cash bail being a source of funding, that was one of the things that the Illinois Sheriff's Association brought up as their concern as the state last year was moving towards eliminating cash bail. Now, first of all, I want to say clearly that we reached out to the Illinois Sheriff's Association multiple times for comment or to see if they would appear on the show today. Did not hear back from them. However, last year, Executive Director Jim Kaichuk did speak to the journalism group called the Center Square, and this was in February of 2020 last year, and he talked about one of his reasons why the Illinois Sheriff's Association opposed eliminating cash bail.
Sheriff's offices, local PDs are all very much under a financial crisis as it relates to training, as it relates to anything else. This is just going to further enhance that crisis because now we don't have any cash bond money that's coming in to help pay for services like, let's say, domestic violence services or sexual assault services or counseling services that would come through the courts.
Christine Scott Hayward, you want to respond to that?
Well, I think it's it's a little disingenuous to be suggesting that the people who are the poorest, who you know should be funding those kinds of programs. And at a larger level, you know, there's no evidence that you know removing cash bail is going to you know ultimately lead to you know worse policing, or which seems to be what's being suggested. The number of people who are locked up, it costs a lot of money to lock somebody up in jail. And so removing cash bail from the system should ultimately, everything should pan out, you know, in the end in terms of the financial issue.
Mm. Well, Jim Kaichuk, again, executive director of the Illinois Sheriff's Association, as I mentioned, they did not respond to our request, but they did talk to the New York Times. And he told the Times that his other area of concern was safety, and not just potential safety for the community, but even mentioned safety for some of the people folks in Illinois who end up in jail, right? He said that jails have become a de facto center for people suffering from mental health disorders. And quote, the only way to intervene is to arrest them and bring them to jail where you have an opportunity to sit in a cell and get some help. And he said that the new law does not take into consideration the lack of resources for defendants who might be released back into the community and not have access to mental health care or drug counseling. Sharon Mitchell, do you want to respond to that?
You know, I think that there is a kernel of truth to what Mr. Kaichuk is saying. Certainly there are counties that do not receive adequate funding for treatment or services, but I think we have to be real with ourselves. Locking someone up in a cage is not a mental health treatment. It's not a drug treatment. People aren't healed through incarceration. They're healed when they're given the things that they need to succeed. And jail doesn't do that. Jail is pretty good at hiding those problems, right? Making sure, you know, we don't see homelessness if we could arrest folks. We don't see folks going through things if we arrest them, but we are not solving the problem in our current situation. And quite frankly, the cost savings that we should see from incarceration should be moving toward those services, and we actually are already seeing that here in Illinois.
Yeah. So, Professor Hayward, so that was regarding the safety and the needs of people who are suffering from mental health disorders or addiction-related disorders, not being able to get services. But sort of the flip side to that is that also many people who are concerned with these potential reforms regarding cash bail are concerned about community safety. Like they're in cases where people are being charged with, you know, violent offenses or domestic violence, and if they're released back into the community, you know, the law enforcement associations say it's a threat to community safety. Does the evidence bear that out?
It doesn't. And can I just actually just say one or two things about follow up on what Sharon said about jails? Because I think it's really important for us to remember that jails are not prisons. And I don't know the Cook County Jail specifically, but most jails are pretty bad at providing health care and mental health care. Right. And so, you know, the rates of deaths in jails are much higher than in the regular population or in prisons. And the rates of suicide are incredibly high also. So I think it's just important to bear that in mind, the notion that somehow people are going to get better mental health treatment in jail than they would in the community. There's nothing to bear that out. And then just to your point about, you know, risk to people in the community. There are always risks, right? And I think one of the things that we try and do when we, you know, reform the system is to figure out how we can sort of protect everybody, right? There's no evidence that cash bail compared with other types of pretrial release increases public safety. And we also know that we could release far more people without any specific, increase in the number of crimes that are being committed. And one of the interesting things about the Illinois statute, because, you know, we do have provisions in most states that allow for detaining people in order to protect community safety. But one of the things that the Illinois bill does really well is that it actually requires that there's a specific threat, right? So you can't lock somebody up just based on the notion that they might, you know, do some violence in the future. You know, maybe they're charged with a violent crime, therefore we think they're going to commit another violent crime. There has to be a specific threat to a specific person. And so that provision should protect, the specific individuals that might be at risk for victimization if the person is released.
Well, a little later in the show about this specific issue of community safety, we'll hear from a former member of the district attorney's office in Washington, D.C., when they underwent a cash bail reform there, about what they learned about the impact on community safety. So we're going to hear about that in a couple of minutes. But now, Christine and Sharon, I want to talk about what you think the lessons are for the rest of the country regarding this step that Illinois has taken. So first of all, I mean, there is a nationwide push amongst criminal justice reform advocates to really take a close look about cash bail in all 50 states. So Alec Karakatsanis is founder of Civil Rights Corps, and they have filed litigation on behalf of people who are currently detained, pretrial detention, because they can't afford to pay bail.
The basic legal arguments that we're raising in all of these cases are about the 14th Amendment and equal protection and due process clauses of the 14th Amendment. We're making a very simple argument that you have a fundamental interest in your own bodily liberty, and the government can't take away your interest in bodily liberty unless it has really good reasons and unless it has a really rigorous process for deciding that it's absolutely necessary to take me away from my family and put me in a cage.
So, Christine Scott Hayward, you said there were specific things in the Illinois bill that you did think would be key elements for other states to pay attention to. What are they?
Well, I think that one that I just mentioned about, you know, requiring a specific threat in order to lock somebody up. One of the problems with some pieces of legislation and reforms is that, you know, it gives a lot of discretion to judges, which can be good, but can also be bad. So in Maryland, for example, they sort of severely restricted cash bail. But what they found was then judges were locking people up based on, you know, community safety concerns or absconding concerns. And so what the Illinois legislation does is that it provides a lot of these protections that Alec was talking about to ensure that, you know, we're really limiting our use of preventive detention. Because although, you know, I think people who are in jail pending trial would experience it as punishment, the Supreme Court has held that it is basically regulatory detention and that it's not punishment. And so it's important for us to ensure that the due process requirements are put in there to make sure that, you know, there are protections and that it is a last resort locking somebody
up. For the sake of clarity here, that's interesting about the Supreme Court's view of this. Does that potentially leave Illinois' new law open to legal challenge?
No. Okay. I mean, basically, yeah, as long as there are protections in place, which is what they do, the legislation is fine.
Okay. Sharon Mitchell, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a really key point. One of the benefits of this bill, whether you're talking about public safety or whether you're talking about justice, whether you're talking about fairness, is we had a system that essentially had a long set of basically a patchwork of laws, contradictory at points, and allowed for hearings that could last, 30 seconds, 1 minute, 2 minutes. What we've done with this bill, we've ended cash bond, but really ending cash bond is like two pages of a 300-page piece. And the majority of the work is done on trying to really sharpen the decision-making process when it comes to who should be in and who should be out. Creating systems that both our Supreme Court have suggested, there's a Supreme Court commission that suggested that we've seen work well in other jurisdictions to make sure that, pretrial freedom is the norm and detention is the exception. But when we are detaining people, we're detaining people because there is a real specific and present threat to a person, or there's a specific willful threat of flight from prosecution. So really being specific about who we're detaining and not just detaining people because they're poor.
Right. And so we'll talk about how you assess that quote-unquote threat in a bit when we come back from a break. We are taking a look at Illinois' sweeping criminal justice reform law that was just passed late last month, and specifically how the state eliminated all cash bail. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In this hour, we're talking about how last month, the state of Illinois passed a sweeping criminal justice reform law. And in that criminal justice reform package was the decision to eliminate the cash bail system in the state of Illinois. It's the first statewide move to completely eliminate it. And I'm joined today by Christine Scott Hayward. She's professor of law, criminology, and criminal justice at California State University, Long Beach, co-author of Punishing Poverty, How Bail and Pretrial Detention Fuel Inequalities in the Criminal Justice System. Sharon Mitchell also joins us as well. He's director of the Illinois Justice Project and is with us from Chicago. Now, earlier in the show, we talked a little bit about how there had been modifications in several states prior to what Illinois did. And also, we want to spend a minute focusing on what Washington, D.C. learned, especially regarding this question of the impact or what impact the elimination of cash bail might have on community safety, because D.C. almost entirely eliminated cash bail just about three decades ago, back in 1992. So we talked with Robert Spagnoletti, who was an assistant district attorney in D.C. at the time. He was the chief of the domestic violence unit there. And at that time, he opposed the change.
Most prosecutors were concerned at the time that we would have an increase in crime, that is, all of these offenders would be immediately back out on the street with no consequence for their immediate arrests, and that crime would increase.
But Spagnoletti says that is not what happened in D.C. But he also adds that eliminating cash bond wasn't just like flipping a switch. It took time for the courts to adjust.
So for the first year, what happened was the judges, so used to putting cash bonds on people, they still impose them. But then, you know, within a week or two, the defendant would make a motion to reduce or eliminate the bond because they couldn't meet it. And so we would have this hearing after hearing after hearing where these people would simply march back in and say, look, I can't pay. I'm still stuck in jail. The judge would be compelled to say, OK, well, if you can't pay, you've got to go.
Well, critics who raise concerns about ending a cash bond system often point to potential increases in dangers to the community. But Spagnoletti says that courts in D.C. were sensitive to that. And in many cases, the courts use other tools rather than pretrial detention to ensure community safety.
The judges got used to putting in other conditions, stay away orders, curfews and things that were designed to protect the community, make sure that if there was a victim, if it was a victim-based crime, the victims were kept safe, but that the defendants wouldn't be kept in jail simply because they could not afford the bond while they were waiting for their actual trials.
And he gives us some examples. For example, in domestic violence cases,
the court can impose a stay-away order from the victim or the victim's residence or the place of work. It could include things like reporting for drug testing and drug screening. It could include things such as, you know, maintain your employment or seek, stay in school if you happen to be in school. So there's a whole panoply of other conditions that can guarantee, you know, to work to guarantee the safety of the community and your return to court, which, of course, is what the court's focus ought to be pre-trial.
Spagnoletti says that Washington, D.C. also has evidence to go along with his assertion of the efficacy of such other tools. For example, he says that more than 90% of people charged with a crime in Washington, D.C. are now released before their trial. The vast majority of them, he says, show up to court and don't commit new offenses in the meantime.
So, yes, I was the chief of the sex offense and domestic violence section. And you would think that those offenders would be the ones who would be held pending trial. The truth is the vast majority were released. The vast majority did not reoffend while they were awaiting trial. And they did, in fact, return for their court hearings. We were also very aggressive about holding them accountable for any violations of those orders.
And Spagnoletti says there was another byproduct of moving away from a cash bail system. It relieved pressure on D.C.'s only jail.
We had significant jail overcrowding, not because these folks were dangerous, not because these folks couldn't really be trusted to return to court, simply because they couldn't afford to pay their bond. When we implemented this new policy, over time, the pressure on the jail greatly reduced. And it also made for better conditions inside the jail, made for less violence, and it also cost the city less, because it was costing the city significant dollars to house folks on very minor crimes, people who were just waiting to have their trial.
So remember, Robert Spagnoletti was an assistant district attorney in Washington, D.C., and he originally had concerns about the elimination of the cash bond system. But he says he believes now it was the right thing to do.
I think that it is a matter of basic fairness and justice that people who are charged but not convicted of crimes need to be presumed innocent. And that includes giving them the benefit of the doubt that they will come back to court and they don't pose a danger to the community. Again, unless there's significant evidence to the contrary. But no one should be kept in jail pending their trial simply because they don't have the resources to pay a cash bail.
So that's Robert Spagnoletti. He was an assistant district attorney in Washington, D.C. about 30 years ago when the district eliminated a cash bond system. You know, Sharon Mitchell, one of the many interesting things, I think, about what Spagnoletti told us there is that it seems as if there were tools available to the court that he outlined there to assure community safety, to not rely on pretrial detention, that were already there. I mean, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I will say this. I think that sometimes the court system can get away with itself or get carried away and think that things like a curfew is the reason why someone follows their pretrial binds their manners on pretrial. But the reality is that the vast majority of people, without any assistance from the court, will come back to court. Will not get back into trouble because they want to resolve their case. I think that sometimes we have this picture, maybe it's through the media, that there are, you know, wildly evil people that, you know, if not detained or if not, you know, put on electronic monitoring shackle, will cause chaos. And in reality, you know, there may be some folks like that, but the vast majority of folks aren't. And it's one of the reasons why you see a diverse set of people that are supporting these changes. You know, in Illinois, for example, the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence, the Network Against Advocate Against Domestic Violence, the Chicago Alliance Against Sexual Exploitation are all supporting this path toward ending money bond because of, you know, a number of reasons. But
Yeah, no, point well taken. But nevertheless, I mean, a judge still has to make a determination, right? Because here, these are cases in which someone has been arrested and will eventually, you know, and charged, right? So yes, eliminating cash bail is a major step. But I think both of you said there's still a lot of discretion in the hands of individual judges. So, Christine Scott Hayward, let me just turn to you quickly on this. The same prejudices and disproportionality that, you know, we understand is embedded in the criminal justice system. I mean, that's still there. How do you feel like the tools are available to judges to trust that those disproportionalities don't happen if they're making individual assessments?
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem, right? Eliminating cash bail doesn't eliminate racial disparities in pretrial decision making, right? And so there has to be a conscious effort on the part of, you know, all of the decision makers involved to ensure that eliminating or at least reducing racial disparity, if entire elimination is not possible, is a goal. And so, you know, just related to the point about what we replace it with, I mean, it's certainly the case that some people need assistance when they are released pending trial, either to show up at court or to, you know, keep things moving in the right direction. But Sharon is absolutely correct. And research doesn't support a lot of these additional conditions, right? You know, drug testing was mentioned, for example, electronic monitoring was mentioned. We have no evidence to suggest that drug testing or electronic monitoring increase appearance rates. And we have a lot of evidence from probation and parole research that shows that putting too many conditions on people can actually backfire. And so, you know, there are some things that can be done that are cheap. You know, court notification programs, for example, are one of the most common inexpensive ways that many jurisdictions are increasing appearance rates, right? You send a text message, a postcard reminder, because most people who don't show up because, you know, they forgot or they couldn't get a ride to court, right? And so there's this assumption that all of these people, we're going to release them and they're dangerous. Mm-hmm. But remember that most people are not locked up because there's been a determination that they're dangerous. They're locked up because they couldn't pay their bail.
Right. So about this determination, though, just one more point on it, because I just feel like there's no point, no area of life that's not being touched by technology. I understand that some jurisdictions are either using or moving towards using assessment algorithms to make those determinations.
Right. So actuarial pretrial risk assessments are one of the most common replacements for money bail. And so, in some places, they're still doing both, actually. And these are, you know, risk assessments that purport to be neutral, right, based on data. But we do know that those risk assessment tools are flawed. They typically overestimate risk. They haven't been able to reduce racial disparities. And so there's a lot of problems. I mean, not to say that at some point there might be some good, you know, tools. And I think Illinois recognizes that because it, you know, you cannot be detained purely based on the results of a risk assessment tool. And, you know, and we could spend hours discussing the pros and cons of risk assessment, but they're not sort of this panacea that will fix the system. And I think it's important to sort of think about the positives and the negatives of those tools.
Mm. Well, in the last few minutes that we have, I want to continue on in this exploration of sort of what are the bigger lessons for the rest of the country here. I'm not currently aware of any state that's like Illinois that's close, it might be in the works, but close to the elimination of total elimination of a cash bond system. But we have seen the growth of things like community bail funds. So Sharon Mitchell, do you want to talk about that a little bit? What are they and how do they work?
Yeah, you know, that is just when, you know, community members get together and essentially post bond for folks who are incarcerated. Here, we enjoy the services of the Chicago Community Bond Fund, who, you know, it's so exciting to work with those folks because they really serve a dual purpose. They are trying to get people out of incarceration who are there because they can't afford it, but they're also working to kind of disrupt the system altogether in the wealth-based incarceration system. So I hate that it took me this long to talk about it, but, you know, our work at ILJP has been in concert with the coalition in Money Bond, which is this big combination of faith-based community members, regular community members, service providers, advocates, and activists. And the Chicago Community Bond Fund has been very active in the coalition and in the network, Illinois Network for Pretrial Justice, to kind of eradicate the wealth-based pretrial incarceration system.
Mm. Christine Scott-Hayward, did you want to comment on that?
No, I think he's absolutely right. And I think those organizations have done a great job of sort of highlighting some of the issues with respect to cash bail, but also noting that they, you know, I think the Brooklyn Community Bail Fund noted that its goal was to eliminate itself, right? The idea would that be that there would be no more need for community bail funds because there would be no more cash bail.
Mm. So ultimately, though, sort of circling back to where we started, the United States is one of two countries that has this reliance on commercial bail bondsmen, and that that uniqueness sort of persists in my mind. In addition, both of you talked about it seems like there's, according to you, there's quite a bit of evidence that shows that concerns about community safety. You know, we know what happens when we move away from bond systems, et cetera, that there's ample evidence that maybe it is the right time for a change. And yet, I'm not sure I see across the country more states closer to that kind of tipping point. Christine Scott-Hayward, why do you think that is?
I mean, part of it is I think that people are always concerned about safety, and it can be quite difficult to sort of demonstrate that, you know, those concerns, you know, we can't eliminate them entirely, but they're not as great as we might anticipate. And people refer to, so California, you know, was the first state to legislatively try and eliminate cash bail, but then the voters rejected that reform on the ballot. But it's complicated because some of the people who rejected it, you know, for reasons related to, you know, concerns about safety, et cetera. But others, others rejected it because it didn't go far enough. And it sort of, you know, replaced cash bail with a system that would possibly have ended up locking more people up. And so it's complicated, and it you know, change is going to be incremental. I think one of the concerns is that, you know, New York's law has been criticized a lot, but it's impossible to tell what the impact of that law would have been without the COVID pandemic, right? Mm. And so New Jersey's law has been very effective, you know, reductions in the number of people locked up without any increase in violent crime or any crime. And so hopefully Illinois will see the same things. The research suggests that we will. And then, you know, more and more states hopefully will see that and increase the efforts toward reform.
Well, we've just got about 30 seconds left, Drew, and I want to give you the last thought for the day. What do you think?
Yeah, ending cash bail is typically weighed through what's purported to be a cost-benefit analysis, but too often it's really a cost-cost analysis. You know, we highlighted this story at the top of Livette Mays, whose life was really turned upside down. And the reality is that is not an outlier. And really too often we see folks' lives turned around by pretrial incarceration, but that's not what hits the news. That's not what's on the cover of the Chicago Tribune or Chicago Sun-Times. So one of the reasons why I think that we're slow to move toward these changes is because these stories don't get to the top. Mm. And Illinois is an example of a state that started to listen to its community and saw the ill of its ways with wealth-based pretrial incarceration.
Well, Sharone Mitchell is director of the Illinois Justice Project. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Christine Scott Hayward, professor of law, criminology, and criminal justice at California State University Long Beach and co-author of Punishing Poverty. Thank you for joining us as well.
No problem.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.